Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, the 1st of October. We have a very, very heavy and very important agenda for you today. We have Ukraine, we have Lebanon, we have the situation along the Lebanon-Syria border, we have Gaza, and we also have briefings on Nepal and briefings and updates and announcements from colleagues from WHO. So we'll start off immediately with a colleague in Ukraine, Liz Throssell of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, who will introduce. Thank you.
Yes, good morning, everyone. We have this morning published our latest report on Ukraine. It covers key human rights developments from the 1st of June to the 31st of August 2024, during which civilian casualties and damage to civilian infrastructure increased significantly. With 589 civilians killed and 2,685 injured.
Sorry, if we can do that again, if we can cut the PA system in the room, that was a bit of an echo. If we can try that one more time. Okay, Liz, if you can start from the beginning again,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, okay, sure. We have this morning published our latest report on Ukraine. It covers key human rights developments from the 1st of June to the 31st of August 2024, during which civilian casualties and damage to civilian infrastructure increased significantly. With 589 civilians killed and 2,685 injured, there was a 45% increase in casualties on the previous 3 months. The deadliest single day was the 8th of July, when a large-scale coordinated missile attack by the Russian Federation left at least 43 civilians dead. The majority of casualties occurred in territory controlled by Ukraine. A significant development was the Ukrainian Armed Forces' cross-border incursion on the 6th of August into the Kursk region of the Russian Federation. While we have established some names of civilians who were killed and injured in connection with this incursion, we have not been able to establish the exact circumstances of these casualties due to a lack of access and limited available public information. In August, we requested that the Russian authorities facilitate our access for these purposes, but to date, this has not been granted. As of the 31st of August, the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine had verified that conflict-related violence had killed 11,743 civilians and injured 24,614 in Ukraine since the 24th of February 2022. During the reporting period, Russian armed forces continued to target energy infrastructure across Ukraine, affecting essential services and deepening concerns about the plight of the civilian population with winter approaching. These trends continued into September. The civilian casualty numbers for September are on track to be as high as in August. Intensive military efforts by Russian armed forces near the front line, Intensive military efforts by Russian armed forces have forced the Ukrainian government to evacuate thousands from near the front line. Attacks across cities across Ukraine, for example in Sumy, Kharkiv, and Zaporizhia, have damaged and destroyed civilian property and infrastructure, including schools, hospitals, and even a geriatric care home. And we have documented even more attacks against Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Regarding prisoners of war, the report, based on hundreds of interviews, details how Russian authorities have subjected Ukrainian prisoners of war to widespread and systematic torture and ill treatment. A range of factors indicate that supervisors in the detention facilities were aware of this treatment and had the ability to prevent it. Some public figures in the Russian Federation have explicitly encouraged inhumane treatment and even killing of Ukrainian prisoners of war. The report also assesses that the Russian prisoners of war were subjected to torture or ill treatment by Ukrainian forces during initial stages of captivity. The High Commissioner for Human Rights will formally present this report to the UN Human Rights Council on the 8th of October. I'll now hand over to Daniel Bell, the head of the Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, for more details about the report's findings on torture and attacks on energy infrastructure. Danielle, over to you.
OK, Okay, can we Danielle, and also do something about the PA system in the room, please? Thank you. Danielle? Go ahead. Danielle, it seems that we have a problem with the audio. We can't hear you here. Could we take a moment to try to correct this situation? Sorry, just if you can be patient with this, colleagues, just for a few seconds. Apologies, colleagues. We're trying to fix this. Okay.
Recording in progress.
Recording in progress.
Recording in progress.
Recording in.
Hello, can you hear me in the room?
Okay, we can hear you now, but there seems to be an echo still in the room. If we can correct that, that would be ideal. Thank you. Let's try one more time. Danielle, could you say something, please? Okay. I think I know that you have to leave soon, Danielle.
Please just give me a signal once it's been remedied.
Okay. Now we hear you. Let's try now. Okay. Go ahead, Danielle, please. Sorry about this. Let's try. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. And how is the sound now in the room?
Now it's fine. Okay. Go ahead, please.
No, thanks so much. Okay, I'll begin by addressing the torture and ill treatment of prisoners of war before turning to some details of our findings on attacks against energy infrastructure. First, since February 2022, my team has interviewed 377 Ukrainian POWs following their release from internment and 434 Russian prisoners of war interned inside Ukraine. The report released today focuses on findings from our interviews conducted over the past 18 months. A key finding of the report, as Liz mentioned, is that Russian authorities have subjected Ukrainian prisoners of war to widespread and systematic torture. We've interviewed 174 Ukrainian prisoners of war, and this includes 5 medics, since March of last year, and almost every single one provided credible and reliable and detailed accounts of torture and severe ill treatment. The POWs described severe beatings, electric shocks, sleep deprivation, dog bites, mock executions, sensory deprivation, threats, and degrading treatment. 68% have reported sexual violence. Torture oral treatment occurs at all stages of captivity during the initial capture, administration procedures, and in the daily routines under appalling internment conditions. The abuses were documented across multiple facilities, both in the occupied territory and in the Russian Federation, showing consistent signs of mistreatment and patterns. Conditions of detention were typically poor, with most POWs reporting food shortages, lack of medical care, overcrowding, and poor hygienic conditions. We documented the death of 10 Ukrainian POWs due to torture, lack of medical care, and dire health conditions. This abuse was not isolated. Several key elements point to coordinated efforts across multiple state entities. For example, the routine nature of the abuse, occurring on a daily or weekly basis and continuing throughout the period of internment, which sometimes it's getting up to 3 years, indicated knowledge of faculty supervisors. Russian public figures have openly called for the inhumane treatment and execution of Ukrainian POWs, often using dehumanizing language in public forums and also through state-owned media. Safeguards meant to prevent torture, such as regular medical care, family communication, oversight, and access by independent monitors, were frequently absent or ineffective. When external officials of the Russian Federation visited internment sites, in many instances, the torture and ill treatment temporarily ceased and conditions improved, indicating that those responsible for these facilities were aware of the mistreatment. These factors, combined with the adoption of broad amnesty laws for Russian service persons, have contributed to a climate of impunity. Turning to Russian POWs, over half, or 104 of the 205 Russian POWs that we've interviewed since March, have reported torture or ill treatment by Ukrainian authorities in almost all cases during the initial phases or the first few days of their internment. Methods included severe beatings, threats of violence, and in some cases, electric shocks. 10 Russian POWs have reported sexual violence. The abuse occurred almost entirely in unofficial or transit locations and typically ended upon arrival into the official internment facilities, where conditions generally meet international standards. My team continues to have unimpeded access to POW internment facilities inside Ukraine, and this has fostered an open and frank dialogue with the authorities and has led to improvements. Let me stress, accountability for abuses remains essential, and ending torture is a legal and moral imperative. Let me move to attacks against energy infrastructure. The report also covers the Russian Federation's attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure and the resulting harm to civilians. The analysis of the report is based on visits to 7 thermal hydroelectric power plant and thermal power plants and substations, 28 community visits, and 112 interviews with local authority, energy experts, tech experts, and residents of affected communities. Between March of this year and August 2024, the Russian Federation launched 9 waves of large-scale coordinated attacks targeting Ukraine's energy generation, primarily thermal, hydroelectric, and heating plants. Many of the facilities were struck repeatedly, some until they were completely destroyed. These attacks hit facilities in 20 regions, including Kyiv. Consequently, this year alone, 9 gigawatts of generation capacity has been destroyed. 73% of thermal power units were rendered inoperative, leading to an energy deficit and a reliance on imports. The cascading damage from these attacks has affected essential services like electricity, water, heating, sewage, public health, and education. Vulnerable populations, for example, older persons, persons with disabilities, lower income households, and children have been disproportionately affected. Last summer, many areas, including here in Kyiv, experienced power outages daily of more than 12 hours. Rolling blackouts are expected to resume this winter. But let me emphasize, significant efforts are underway to restore Ukraine's generation capacity and to mitigate the risks of a harsh winter. But this situation is exacerbated by ongoing attacks. Before we open up for questions, I would like to reiterate or return the civilian protection concerns that Liz raised. We know this, we documented a 45% increase in civilian casualties compared to the previous 3-month period during this attack. And as Liz said, this continued until September. noting, for example, the deadly attack on a hospital in Sumy on Saturday, which killed 10 and injured more than 20, is a sobering reminder of how civilians across Ukraine continue to be affected by this war. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Danielle, and of course, Liz, for those briefings. We have a question. We'll start in the room and then we'll go online. Christoph, AFP.
Hi, Christophe Vogt, Agence France-Presse. Thanks for taking my question and for the briefing. I was just wondering if you could tell us, you said that the Ukrainian authorities were collaborating, that you have unimpeded access to the detention facilities. I was also wondering if you have any idea if there have been any indictments yet or even any trial sentences for the people responsible. And if I got you right, those abuses really happen in the first few days of people getting into detention before getting to the facilities where they will be held for a longer time, yes?
Thank you for the question, Christoph. Yes, we have unfettered access to internment centers in Ukraine. So this includes the four POW camps. We visited all of them and we visit regularly, as well as the CISOs or the jails that sometimes temporarily accommodate Russian POWs. So for example, facilities in Dnipro, Zaporizhia, Kherson, etc. So we have access and we are able to carry out a very open dialogue with Ukrainian authorities on where to make improvements. You asked about accountability. The Office of the Prosecutor has opened up five investigations into acts of torture, but these haven't proceeded beyond the initial investigative phases, and we hope that that will take place soon. I hope that answers the question. Over.
Thank you very much, Danielle. We have a question now. Is that satisfied? Okay. No further questions in the room? No? Okay, then we'll turn to Yuri of RIA Novosti. Yuri, over to you. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Rolando. Good morning, Liz. Good morning, Danielle. I have, in fact, three questions because I have read the whole report, so for some precisions. For the first one, you have just said that more than the half of the 205 Russian prisoners of war interviewed by your office, more than the half report about torture and mistreatment, but you are not considering that despite this very high percentage, the torture and mistreatment of Russian prisoners of war in Ukraine is common. So I just wanted to understand why, what is the difference? Why are you not talking about systematic when this is more than the half? And even knowing that no one has been prosecuted for this act by the procurer, only five cases have been open, but no one was suspected in that. Do you want to take question by question maybe, or do you want to take the...
I think question by question, because these are important questions and I don't want to skim over them, if that's okay.
Okay.
Yuri, first, thank you for reading the report cover to cover and for the questions. Yes, more than half of Russian POWs have been tortured or ill-treatment. It occurs, but the difference between the treatment of the Russian POWs and the Ukrainian POWs is different in scope and scale. So with the Russian POWs, it takes place at the initial capture, in the early days, and it stops and they're safe once they're inside the internment facilities. Does that make it okay? Does that make it legal? Absolutely not. Why haven't we used the widespread and systematic language when it's happening to almost half? The scope and scale of torture in the Russian Federation and occupied territories of the Ukrainians is different. First, the geographic spread. My team has documented instances of detention in 60 unofficial sites and 76 official internment sites inside the Russian Federation. And of these 76 facilities, for example, more than in 57 of them, we document torture on a regular basis. Second, so it's geographic spread. Second, in terms of frequency and duration, it's not just happening once or twice when, you know, they're first captured or an odd time or random. It's happening through the duration of their internment. So when we're interviewing the Ukrainian POWs, when they've come back, you know, after 2.5 years, They're telling us about torture in multiple facilities throughout the internment, and it's happening on a daily or weekly basis. So, for example, I interviewed a returned POW about 10 days ago, and he said a day doesn't go by without somebody being beaten. Another factor that led to this assessment is the number of state entities involved. So it wasn't limited to just one group, because there are groups and certain shifts at certain facilities where it doesn't happen. But because it is happening across the places by different bodies, that also contributed. Another is the indicated knowledge of the torture and ill treatment by those running the facilities. For example, what POWs have been telling us consistently is in advance of an inspection or a visit by an external authority, the conditions change. So for example, the torture and ill treatment stops for a period of time and the food rations increase. And then it goes back to the way it was before after the inspection. And so this indicates a knowledge or awareness of those running the facilities that the torture is indeed taking place. But again, to coming back to your point, you know, accountability is essential and initiating investigations is not sufficient. Every act of torture must be thoroughly investigated and every perpetrator needs to be held accountable. So sorry for the long answer, Yuri, but that was a really good question. And I look forward to your second question, please.
Thanks, Daniel.
Yes, thank you very much for the precision of the answer, really. My second question is about, you have a part in the report that is talking about the civil rights in Ukraine. And I was quite surprised because there is absolutely nothing about the issue of the forced and violent mobilization. Even if we can see every day dozens of videos across the country with people that being just catches in the streets, taken and thrown to buses. And this is really every day in Ukraine. And every day there is scandals with TCK, with the mobilization center, with some people that have been beaten there that can't call to their family, can't call an advocate. And there is nothing in your report. I just wondering why.
Thank you for the question. And indeed, mobilization and conscription is a hot topic and a very important topic in Ukraine right now. My team, when we receive accounts of mistreatment and such conduct around conscription, we follow up these cases. And what we haven't seen is these cases amounting to the level of torture, et cetera. So it doesn't mean we're not following up on it, but we are aware of it. And if we do see an increase or if we see greater patterns, indeed it will be included. But this is something we are watching. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Daniel. Yuri, did you have one last question? We do have a number of other hands up.
Is a last.
Okay, go ahead.
This is on the Kursk region. In your report, you are saying that you have, register some casualties, for some civilian casualties, but you can't say what are the circumstances. So in your report, there is no clearly saying who is the responsible of that. So it means that in your report, we can just see that there are casualties, but you couldn't find any proof or argument saying that the firing of the Russian army against the region, for example, are responsible for civilian casualties. But you are doing this, for example, in Ukraine. When Russia is bombing somewhere, you can say that Russia is responsible for that. Why it is not the case for the Kursk Oblast?
Good. So thank you, Yuri, for the question. So in the report, we document 12 civilian deaths and 12 civilian deaths and 201 civilian injured. And most of those casualties occurred during the early days, like in the first week after August 6th. In terms of attribution, like why aren't we naming one party or another? In the context of intensive fighting and in fighting on both sides, it is almost impossible for us to precisely determine attribution in the context of crossfire. Having said that, as Liz said at the beginning of her presentation, the OHCHR has requested access into these areas, as well as to occupied territory. And having access to these areas would allow us to fully document the circumstances of individual attacks. So, for example, with other attacks and the attacks where we have given attribution, it's because we have had, or it's contributed because we have had direct access to some of these areas. Thank you again for the really good question.
Thanks to you, Danielle. Okay, we have a few more hands up. So Lisa Schlein, Voice of America. Lisa.
Thanks, Rolando. Good morning, and good morning, Danielle. Yeah, very interesting and disturbing. I'd like to ask you about the Russian attacks against power grids. Do you have any concerns about the possibility of any of the nuclear facilities being attacked either deliberately or by accident?
No, thank you for the question, Lisa. And as you pointed out, attacks against energy infrastructure is a huge concern in Ukraine right now. In terms of the attacks against nuclear facilities, this is something that we're monitoring. We can't predict what will be happening in the coming days, weeks, months, but you know, obviously it's a concern, and we're hoping that the aerial defense systems will mitigate any incoming aerial attacks to these facilities. At the same time, we are worried about the upcoming winter, and it's impossible to predict what will happen this winter. For example, if the attacks continue, the blackouts may be intensified. The repairs to the destroyed and damaged thermal power plants and substations are underway, and we hope this continues. And there's a lot more, if I can also point out, Lisa, the Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine has also issued a bulletin specifically on this topic. It's on our website, and it gives some more details, or it adds on to the periodic report that was issued today. So I encourage you to go into that report, and there'll be some more details to more precisely answer your question.
Thank you so much, Danielle. Okay, Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you, Ms. Bell, for coming to see us. It's really nice to have you. I just wanted to follow up on two issues. The first is, if you could just sort of put it in a nutshell, the differences between the types of torture that you're hearing both of Ukrainian POWs and Russian POWs. Is it safe to say that the torture that exists of Russian POWs or Russian detainees in Ukraine is happening very quickly, or right at the beginning, whereas in Russia it is happening, Ukrainian POWs is happening much more long term? I think if you could just summarize that in a single sentence. And then the second question I have is, I assume that I think you said 200 or 104 Russian POWs that you had interviewed, that was done in Ukrainian detention facilities. So I'm wondering, what access do you, or what access did the United Nations generally have to POWs in custody in Russia or in Russian-controlled territories? Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jamie. In a nutshell, the summary you provided is accurate. But what I need to emphasize is torture is always wrong. It doesn't matter if it happens once or 50 times, it's wrong every time. But yes, with the Ukrainian POWs, it happens across internment facilities, both in the Russian Federation and occupied territory, and it happens at the different facilities. So the guys that we interview have often been held in 3, 4, 7 facilities. So it's happening through the duration. So it's, and with the Russian POWs, almost every single instance that we've recorded in the past 18 months has been in the first few days of their capture, either in a temporary internment center or where they're initially interrogated. once they're transferred to the camps or to the CISOs, they're safe. And so again, we have access, to the Ukrainian POWs after they've been transferred, and we typically will interview them while they're receiving treatment in the hospital or other locations. So we usually interview them a couple of weeks after they've been back. Regarding the treatment and access, you asked about the Russian POWs. Yes, we interview them at the camps and in the jails. We have full access. And yes, half in the past 18 months, so 104 of the 205 have reported torture or ill treatment. You ask, do we have access to POWs in the Russian Federation? We do not. And as Liz had said, we've been, you know, asking for access for a long time. So this is why we interview the Ukrainian POWs once they've been released.
Thank you very much, Danielle. We have one final question for you from Gabriela Sotomayor of El Proceso, Mexico. Gabby.
I can't hear Gabriela's question.
Nor can I. Let's try to, maybe she is unmuted. Gabby, could you unmute yourself, please? We'll have to.
My email later on.
Yeah, Gabby, thank you. Thank you, Danielle, for offering that way of communicating. Yeah, I think we'll have to move on then to the next subject. And maybe, Gabby, if you can pose your question maybe to Liz. Okay. Go ahead, Gabby. We can hear you now. Please go ahead.
My question is for Liz Throssell in another subject.
Okay, if it's another subject, ask for your indulgence, if you can wait. We have a lot of other briefers on other subjects, so yeah. If we can wait until the end, that would be great. So I just wanted to thank you again, Danielle. It's really great to have you join us here, and of course, you're welcome back anytime. With that, I will turn nod to my colleague in the second row there, Jens Lark of the Office for the Coordination for Humanitarian Affairs, who has an announcement about a humanitarian flash appeal for Lebanon. And just to note that we will take questions strictly on the flash appeal, and then we'll go on to the situation in Lebanon with Liz and a colleague from IFRC. But Jens, over to you.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. The United Nations and our humanitarian partners in Lebanon have just launched with the government a 3-month flash appeal to address rapidly escalating humanitarian needs in the country. The appeal aims to support 1 million people with humanitarian assistance. The ask to international donors is $426 million. Since mid-September, Lebanon has experienced an unprecedented surge in casualties and displacement. In just the past 2 weeks, more than 1,000 people have lost their lives and over 6,000 have been injured. Since October last year, and rapidly escalating in these past weeks, there are today an estimated 1 million people directly affected or displaced by the crisis. Those are the ones that we are responding to with the flash appeal. And that is according to the Lebanese authorities, those numbers. We and our NGO partners are already responding with food, nutrition for children, water, and essential supplies such as mattresses and hygiene and emergency health kits, the basics for people's survival and well-being. Distribution is taking place, especially in collective sites housing displaced families. This appeal aims to rapidly reinforce and scale up these essential services in support of the government-led response, and we, of course, appeal to the donors to look at that and support it. I want to add that you will have seen in recent hours the reports of the beginning of an Israeli ground offensive in southern Lebanon, and we are deeply concerned about this development. We urge all parties to prioritize the protection of civilians, adhere to international humanitarian law, and engage in immediate de-escalation to prevent further loss of life and to prevent further suffering. Now, we have just launched this appeal for the needs that we know, but we fear that with these developments, things could get worse. Now, we have warned time and time again for almost a year against the widening of this conflict. And why do we do that? Because I think if there's one universal truth in humanitarian affairs, it is that it is infinitely easier and faster to break things and hurt people than it is to fix them. So de-escalate now.
Thank you very much, Jens. Let's maybe take questions strictly on the appeal. Then we do have Liz and her colleague from IFRC who will speak also to the situation in Lebanon. But let's take questions for Jens now. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, hi, Jens. You mentioned 1 million people in need. Do you know how many of them are Palestinian refugees in Lebanon? Can you disaggregate the number? And the other question is talking about finance again. How much is the flash appeal for Gaza finance right now? You're launching this one in Lebanon, but what's the percentage of the funding right now for the one in Gaza?
Thanks, Jeremy. The situation is rather chaotic, and people are still on the move and being displaced. And with the recent developments we're seeing, we should expect more displacement. Of course, mostly from southern Lebanon, but also from the southern densely populated suburbs of Beirut, which have also come under heavy attack. It is a mixed population group in Lebanon, as you know. I think we estimate there's about 1.5 million refugees from Syria over the decade or more of war and conflict there. There are Palestinian refugees as well. There are other nationalities. And, you know, they are spread out in some of the Palestinians have lived in camps, we know, in southern Lebanon. Others have settled there for a very long time, but still have status of refugee. So I can't give you a complete breakdown at the moment. What we look at when we issue an appeal like this is, okay, what is the totality of the needs over the past year? Because we are looking at an escalation in recent months, but it started 11 months ago with rockets flying in both directions, but particularly now into Lebanon. So 1 million is a target, it's a number we have from the government, and that's what we are trying to address with this, I would say, large appeal. It's for 3 months. Over $400 million.
Thanks very much, Jens. Okay, Jamie Keaton, AP. Oh, sorry, you want to add before you go to
Jamie? Excuse me, I forgot the second one. Give me a second and I will look up what the
Thanks, my bad. Is. Okay, if we can get back on that one. And then we'll turn in the meantime to Jamie, AP.
Thanks, Rolando. I just wanted to know if anybody, either you or Jens or anyone else, but presumably you, can discuss the situation with the UNIFIL troops in Lebanon, particularly what their activities are given the ground incursion that was just referenced. I mean, are there any plans to do anything with those UNIFIL troops? Or are they just going to hunker down? Can you address that? Thanks.
Yeah, I think I'll need to connect. We don't have lines. I don't have lines at the moment, but I'll need to connect with our colleagues. We do have colleagues in Akur in the south in the Blue Line area. So I'll just need to check with them and double back to you. If I get something during this briefing, I'll certainly share that with you. In the meantime, I don't know if you had another question for Jan specifically, or maybe the second part of that question. I don't know if you had anything for Jeremy yet, or should we go to the next question? Jens.
Next question then.
Okay, we'll do that. Still working. Casmira, Geneva Solutions.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was just wondering how many staff you have on the ground in Lebanon, and also in terms of logistics, how difficult it is at the moment, just to give an idea of what it's like to actually get the essentials in and where you're distributing them as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I don't have an overall number of UN staff There are a great many UN organizations in Lebanon. It's normally something we asked UN Department for Safety and Security about. I don't know if there are any concerns there. But there are certainly a substantial number of UN staff, and we have tragically seen several who have been killed. We know that many of them have been displaced as well, including staff from my own organization. So that is what I can say about that. In terms of logistics of getting stuff in and stuff out, it is not something that I have heard as an immediate concern. However, it's always of concern when we hear about, as we have heard in recent days, closure of airports, right, in Beirut, which has come under attack. That's always a concern. Moving things around, for now, seems to be possible, but it is a function of the hostilities and where the bombs may fall next.
Okay, great. I have a short update I can share with you in terms of UNIFIL. And I mean, of course, despite the extremely difficult situation, our troops in the south of Lebanon, UNIFIL, military and civilian peacekeepers remain committed to their mission and continue to adapt to deliver on the mission's mandate. And UNIFIL continues to engage actively with the parties. And of course, it stands ready to facilitate any diplomatic efforts. So this is really just the general lines that we have, but of course we can dig deeper and maybe check with our colleagues, the spokesperson at the mission, who I will pose your question to, Jamie, and we can also reconnect you, or rather connect you with our colleagues in southern Lebanon. Yes, Jens, you wanted to add something maybe to the first question.
Yeah, to Jeremy's question, it's about the flash appeal that we have for the OPT. So it actually covers both Gaza and the West Bank. It's the entire population of Gaza and a very substantial part. I think it's 700,000 in the West Bank. The requirements are $3.4 billion. It's currently 49% funded. 49%.
Thank you. We still have three questions, and we do have Liz and our colleague from IFRC who also address the situation on the ground. But let's turn now to Moussa Al-Mayadeen. Moussa, over to you.
Merci. Vous m'entendez?
Oui, maintenant, oui. Allez-y.
OK. Alors, j'ai deux questions. La première pour Jens, concernant les déplacés qui vivent aujourd'hui dans les écoles. Et une partie, comme on voit, comme nous on voit les images depuis Beyrouth, vivent au bord de la mer. Et donc, aujourd'hui ou demain, ça va commencer à pleuvoir. Quelle est la situation de ces parties de déplacés? Est-ce que vous avez donc assez d'aide pour remédier cette histoire, pour venir en aide aux réfugiés qui sont dans les écoles et surtout au bord de la mer? Ça, c'est la première. La deuxième, concernant l'UNIFIL, d'après les informations, l'UNIFIL se sont retirés hier à la demande d'Israël quand Israël a annoncé le début d'une attaque terrestre. Donc, ils ont quitté leur position. Je voudrais savoir si vous avez cette information et si vous l'avez, c'est quoi les détails? Merci.
Thank you. The short answer to your first question is no. We do not have enough supplies, we do not have enough capacity, and that's exactly why we are launching this appeal, because we need this additional injection of funds to actually procure it and have the staff and capacities in place to increase the response, which is not where it should be, because we are, as usual, running after the fact. As I said, it's easy to break things and hurt people, but getting them back to some sort of normality takes a very long time and it costs a lot of money. So that's why we need to stop this development de-escalate the conflict as soon as possible. We are distributing primarily in the collective shelters. I believe there is around 800 schools and possibly other public facilities that the government has opened, which also, of course, tragically means that kids are not going to school, but they are sheltering displaced families. They are in one place, so it is, if you like, easier to actually distribute food and mattresses and that sort of thing en masse when people are gathered in one place. All of these displaced people, many of them are moving from place to place. They're sheltering with friends and families, as you know better than I do. It can be difficult to reach them. But of course, the intention is to provide the support for the full 1 million people that have been identified as in need.
Moussa, maybe I will try to connect you and get some updated lines with the situation pertaining to our mission in Lebanon, UNIFIL. But of course, the idea, we strongly urge the parties to recommit to Security Council Resolution 1701 as the only viable solution to bring back stability in the region. And of course, of paramount importance is the safety and well-being of our staff while trying to continue our mandate under these very dire circumstances. But I'll connect you with colleagues and see if we can get some updates as they are very fluid. Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking the question. Jens, there's been quite a lot of pledges of aid already coming in from France, Canada, and from the region, from Egypt and the Gulf countries. I think there was even $100 million pledged by the UAE. Is that coming in through the UN? Is this being coordinated by the UN? What is the kind of mechanism for getting some kind of coherent international operation here?
Thank you, Nick. I don't have the details of that. Of course, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs stands ready and is available to help coordinate incoming international aid in Lebanon and elsewhere.
Okay, maybe we'll turn, John, for the last question to Jens, and then we'll have to open it up to other briefers on the same subject, but from a different point of view. Maybe John Zarakostas, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Jens. I was wondering on your flash appeal if you have a bit of a breakdown of the two or three priority areas that where the money you hope will go of the 426 million. Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you, John. I sent you all a note, and there's a link there to the full flash appeal, and you will see on page 5 there's an overview of the different sectors and clusters, where there's this specific breakdown in terms of how much money each one needs. Basic assistance is very high. That basically means food and other really survival supplies. We also have shelter as very high. Education is also high. And of course, protection of civilians, which is extremely important here.
Thank you very much, Jens. Okay, maybe I'm going to throw to Liz, but maybe just to give you a further update, if you will, I just received something from our colleagues in the region. And just to mention that despite the dangerous development, peacekeepers, UNIFIL peacekeepers, that is, they remain in position. We are regularly adjusting our posture and activities, and we have contingency plans ready to activate if absolutely necessary. Peacekeeper safety and security is paramount, and all actors are reminded of their obligation to respect it. These are just some lines that were just shared with me. Again, we can provide more details should you need those. Liz, over to you, and then we'll afterwards throw it to our colleague who's joining us from Beirut, from the IFRC. But Liz, over to you first.
Yes, thank you, Rolando. We are gravely concerned by the widening hostilities in the Middle East and their potential to engulf the entire region in a humanitarian and human rights catastrophe. The prospects that the situation may deteriorate further with a terrible impact on civilians and that it could rapidly expand to embroil other states in the region are real. With armed violence between Israel and Hezbollah boiling over, the consequences for civilians have already been awful. And we fear a large-scale ground invasion by Israel into Lebanon would only result in greater suffering. Israeli strikes in Lebanon have reportedly killed over 1,000 people in the past 2 weeks alone. Hundreds of thousands have also been displaced in Lebanon, alongside those recently fleeing into Syria. And over 60,000 have been displaced in Israel since Hezbollah's escalation of missile fire from October the 8th last year. Even before the most recent escalation in mid-September, tens of thousands of homes across Lebanon had been reportedly damaged or destroyed by attacks. Medical facilities have been damaged, with 10% of health centers in Lebanon closed. 41 medical workers have been reportedly killed and 111 wounded since October 2023, with 14 killed in the last 2 days alone. 25 water facilities have been damaged, impacting nearly 300,000 people. Schools and nurseries have been closed and some 300 converted into shelters. In northern Israel and parts of the northern occupied West Bank, sirens have sounded and residents instructed to remain close to shelters, limit their movements and avoid gatherings. The impact of the escalation resulting from Houthi missile fire from Yemen into Israel and Israeli attacks in response are also deeply troubling. All parties to these conflicts must clearly distinguish between military targets and civilians and civilian objects in the way they conduct hostilities. They must do all they can to protect the lives of civilians, their homes, and the infrastructure essential to their daily existence, as clearly required by international humanitarian law. Too many innocent children, women, and men have been killed, and too much destruction has been exacted. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, urges all parties to pursue negotiations to end the current path of destruction and violence that shows no end in sight. He reminds everyone to ensure accountability of those responsible for violations of international humanitarian law that have taken place or are ongoing, whoever the perpetrators may be, and to ensure justice for the victims. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Again, in the interest of time, I'm just going to give the floor to Christian Cortez, who's the IFRC, who's the head of the delegation for IFRC for Lebanon, is joining us from Beirut, and then we'll take questions on the overall subject of Lebanon. Christian, over to you.
Good morning, and thank you to being here. I would like to start with a personal history. A few days ago, my wife's brother was killed in the line of duty while rescuing others. He served with dedication in the Lebanese civil defense. His death taught devastating. It's not just a personal loss for our family. He joins the heartbreaking list of Lebanese humanitarian workers and civilians who have tragically lost their life in the recent escalation. He left behind his wife and 3 young children, and like 1,000 of other Lebanese, they now face the hardship of the displacement. I start with this history to show how personal this is. He's just one of millions of stories of fear and trauma. Tension has been escalating for months, of course, but over the last week, it has escalated into humanitarian crisis. I will sketch out the needs, the how Lebanese Red Cross and the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, both supported by IFRC, are responding. Since mid-September, the situation in Lebanon has deteriorated significantly. We are seeing high number of displacements, intense violence, and increasing humanitarian needs. Nevertheless, this escalation comes on top of the Lebanon severe economic crisis, where around 75% of the population live below the poverty line. Lebanese Red Cross has been at the front line of the emergency response from the first day. They are the first primary responders of the emergency services in the country. They are working 24/7 in the transportations and evacuation of injured around the country, especially in the south area, Beka area, and surrounded. They have around 51 ambulance centers, 13 blood transfusion centers across the country, and 15 rescue teams that they are working, as I mentioned, 24/7. Since the escalation, they are responding to thousands of medical emergencies, providing critical care and distributing food and essential supplies to displaced families. However, the challenges are immense. Lebanese Red Cross is facing shortage of medical supplies, ambulance, and fuel. And the efforts are also severely underfunded. As an IFRC, we allocate 2 million Swiss francs as a part of our disaster response emergency fund on September 23rd. But overall, our IFRC emergency appeal, that is for a total of 55 million Swiss francs for Lebanon, is only 12% covered. We urgently need international support to address the growing crisis and to keep humanitarian operations running in Lebanon. For Syria, the impact of the conflict is also being felt across the border in Syria. We know that around 89,000 people are displaced to Syrian between Lebanese and Syrian population. Many are returning Syrian nationals, but a high proportion as well Lebanese. The Syrian Arab Red Crescent is actively responding to the influx, working in the border, providing urgent medical care, relief suppliers, and shelter. They are deploying as well mobile health units and emergency medical teams to assist the people in need. What all this mean? Today, more than ever, Lebanon needs the support of the international community. Financial support is needed, yes, but also pressure from governments to on those in the table to introduce some restraint to end hostilities. We call all the parties to the conflict to respect IHL. Humanitarians and civilians should not be a target. The Lebanese Red Cross and the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, with the backing of the IFRC, remain committed to providing critical humanitarian assistance under incredibly challenging circumstances. With this response, cannot continue without international support. Thank you, and I am happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cortez, and of course, expressing to you and your family and the people of Lebanon condolences. We will take questions starting on the room. No questions in the room. So we have Gabby again. I think she had a question for Jens, if I'm looking at the chat correctly. So Gabby, over to you.
Yes, thank you very much, Rolando. I have a question for Jens and for Mr. Cortez. How much money did you receive from Russia, China, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, USA, and European Union? If you can give us a little bit of more details. Thank you so much.
You caught me on the wrong foot there. I don't have those numbers. I would need you to specify, is that total funding for all appeals? Is it this year? Is it for these appeals? I'll need a bit more details. Maybe you can write to me or text me and we can sort it out and
for
I'll try
Lebanon,
to find the numbers.
For Lebanon. No, well, only for Lebanon.
Well, for Lebanon, prior to this, we did not have a humanitarian response plan for Lebanon. Mm. Okay, there is another response plan which is broader, into which we have folded humanitarian needs. It's a bit complicated, but the short of the long thing is that we did not have that. So this is the first humanitarian appeal this year, strictly humanitarian for Lebanon. So we have just launched it right now. So we'll have to wait, of course, some time to see how the donors respond, and I'll happy to look out for the list of, I didn't catch all of them, but for the list of countries that you are interested in.
Thanks, Jens. Gabby, did you have a question specifically for Mr. Cortez?
Yes, the same question that that I asked for Jens.
Okay, Mr. Cortez, if you can provide any details.
Thank you so much. For us, you know, our funding is coming through the different Red Cross and Red Crescent members. Until now, we are undercover. We have only 12% of covering of our appeal. Our support is through mainly our Red Cross and Red Crescent movement partners.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cortez. Musa?
Oui, merci beaucoup. Ma question pour Lise. How do you describe the assassination of the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, from a human rights perspective? As you know, the attack targeted six buildings in Beirut. Thank you.
Thank you for that. This has sent shockwaves reverberating around the region. I think what we have seen unfolding in recent days has added to our concerns, which is why we've said we are gravely concerned by the widening hostilities in the Middle East. You're referring to targeting someone. Clearly, the Israelis had their reasons for targeting Hassan Nasrallah. What we are always concerned about, and we repeat it time and time again, is the impact on civilians, the impact on innocent children, women, men of hostilities, which is why we are saying, the High Commissioner is saying yet again, halt this path of destruction and violence that has no end in sight. The hostilities must stop. And I think we've heard it powerfully from our colleague from IFRC in Lebanon about the impact that this has. It's not abstract. It impacts families. It has personal consequences, as you could hear in his voice, how he and his family have been impacted. So I think that's what we would say at the forefront of everything. For us, is the protection of civilians and abiding by international humanitarian law. Easy things to say, of course, and we've seen that these have not been regarded in recent years in other conflicts as well as this one. But I think we reiterate, for us, protection of civilians is paramount. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. Before going to Nina and Gabby, on that question, yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Liz, could you just clarify when you say that the Israelis had their reasons to target Nasrallah? Do you mean there were good reasons? They could be legally defended? Can you just clarify what you mean by that?
We're not party to what the Israelis may be thinking, so we can't comment directly on that. I mean, it would assume that for them to carry out such an act, they would have their reasons. We will obviously be gathering more information on this and what happened, but that is not something that we are in a position to respond to directly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Liz. And I'm going to double back to Musa because I think you might have a follow-up on that same point. Musa?
Oui, exactement. Donc, suite à la question de tout à l'heure, selon les lois internationales, est-ce que Israël a le droit d'attaquer Hassan Nasrallah? Il était dans son QG. Mais est-ce qu'il n'était pas militaire, donc il n'est pas au front? Je ne sais pas. J'aimerais savoir ce que disent les lois internationales concernant cette situation exactement. Merci. Donc, à part que, il y a des civils, il y a sa famille, tout ça, mais je voudrais bien comprendre la situation de Hassan Nasrallah directement et pas les civils qui sont tombés autour. Merci.
Yeah, thank you, Musa. I mean, this is not an incident that we're able to comment directly on. As you know, we respond frequently to questions of this nature, citing international humanitarian law, the respect for protection of civilians, respect and abiding by the principles of distinction and proportionality and precaution in attack. But we're not in a position to comment directly on this.
Thank you very much, Liz. Okay, two more questions, then we'll have to go to our colleague Louise from UNRWA, who has been waiting patiently. So, Nina, AFP.
Yeah, thank you for taking my question. It's on the same subject, but it was about the bomb that was used in the attack on Nasrallah, which apparently was one of these 2,000-pound bunker blasters. Your office has put, Liz, your office has put out a report previously about these large bombs being used in civilian, densely populated civilian areas in Gaza. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on the use of this bomb in this attack. Thank you.
Well, as I said, we're not really in a position to comment directly on the attack, but heavy weapons such as the one that you were describing are of grave concern, precisely because of these principles that I referred to earlier, you know, the principles of distinction, precaution, attack, and proportionality. The size of these bombs do raise huge concerns with regard to them hitting sort of civilian areas and the resulting civilian casualties. But as I say, we're not in a position to comment directly on what may have happened, what may have been the actual circumstances of what happened the other day. Thank you.
Thank you again, Liz. Okay, one final question. Gabby, once again, over to you.
Yes, thank you, Rolando. I have questions for Liz on another subject. Can I ask?
If you don't mind, I'm sorry, but I really need to throw now to Louise Waterridge of UNRWA, who's been waiting patiently. Gabby, if we can just kindly ask.
I need the record. Going
anywhere. Liz promises to answer. You're hearing her. Just stay. Patient, if you don't mind, okay? Thank you very much. So I apologize for that, but let's turn now to Louise Waterridge of UNRWA, who's joining us from Amman, and she has an update on the situation in Gaza. Then we have other subjects afterwards. Louise, thanks again for your patience. Over to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so it's been 12 months of brutal war in the Gaza Strip. My colleague Mohammed's daughter was born on the 31st of October in Gaza City. Through relentless bombing, he rushed his wife, Mai, to a hospital himself because they couldn't get an ambulance, which they were busy responding to people injured in strikes. She delivered her baby at a hospital with limited medication, surrounded by people screaming in fear and dying. A similar experience to that of around 50,000 women who've given birth during the war. On December 5th, my colleague's four-year-old daughter, Salma, was shot in the neck and died in her father's arms as the family were trying to flee Gaza City. At least 11,000 children have been reported killed in the last 12 months, although the exact number is presumed higher because many are still buried under the rubble. In January, we lost contact with my colleague, Hussein, for a whole week when the UNRWA facility his family was sheltering in was besieged, surrounded by tanks, trapping over 40,000 people inside. Ambulances and emergency teams were denied access. When we finally got through to him, he told us he was burying the bodies of those killed, including children, in the courtyard. 198 UNRWA facilities have been hit since the start of the war, and many while sheltering families inside of them. Some of the most impactful images of this war have been taken by my colleague Abdullah. In February, Abdullah was hit in a strike while documenting North Gaza. Both of his legs had to be amputated. While doctors tried to keep him alive in Al-Shifa, the hospital came under Israeli siege. Miraculously, the UN was able to reach him. I was first permitted entry to Gaza myself in April and visited Abdullah in a field hospital in Rafah. Doctors informed us he only had days to live because they did not have the equipment or medicine necessary to treat him further. My two colleagues who had matching blood types donated their blood on the spot just to keep him alive. 2 months after being hit, he was finally approved medical evacuation just days before the Rafah crossing closed permanently. Today, there are more than 10,000 people still in urgent need of medical evacuation in the Gaza Strip. In May, my colleague Jamal was one of the first people to flee Rafah due to the evacuation orders and start of military operations in the area. The first night he arrived in Deir al-Bala, he was killed sleeping with his family by an airstrike. Meanwhile, Mohammed, fearing nowhere safe to go, was one of the last people to flee Rafah with his family. Not far from his own shelter, he bore witness to an airstrike that killed families sleeping in a tented area. The screams of children burning alive still keep him awake now. As disease has spread through the shelters and camps through summer months, my colleague Raja has had to care for her sister, who caught hepatitis A. With no access to medicine and no clean water, she's been malnourished for months of poor diet. We're now at 12 months into this war, and I can tell you that 1.9 million people have been displaced. I can tell you that a reported 41,000 people have been killed. I can tell you that 63% of buildings have been damaged or destroyed, but I cannot quantify the horrors that people have endured relentlessly for 12 months. I cannot fully portray the fear instilled upon an entire population every hour of every day. I cannot share the overwhelming smell of blood in hospitals surrounding doctors in despair, unable to save countless children. The situation in Gaza right now is as bad as it's ever been. Our ask has remained the same during the last 12 months of war. We need an immediate ceasefire, the return of the hostages, and safe and sustained delivery of aid to give families a chance to rebuild their lives. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Louise. As difficult as it is to hear these statistics, it is indeed very good that you share those with us here. Do we have questions for Louise? Okay, Gabby, I'm not sure if this is for Louise, but if so, I think I know you have a question for Liz, but I just wanted to make sure we...
On Gaza.
Okay, please. Thank you, Gabby. Thank you. Over to you. Yes.
And then, please, my questions. Is international community forgetting about Gaza because of what is happening in Lebanon? Do you think, that, are you feeling that way or... Thank you.
I think from what colleagues and people on the ground expressed to me in Gaza is there's always a fear that they have been forgotten throughout the 12 months, not just in the recent weeks of escalations. They fear the world overlooks their suffering and their pain, and they fear that not enough is able to be done or being done to help their cause and what they need. So, yes, I mean, 12 months into this horrific war, I think it is, you know, I can express on behalf of people who speak to me that they do feel forgotten, and they do feel that their needs are not as important as others, and what they need, just basic things, food, water, shelter, are completely overlooked in such devastating circumstances.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that, Louise. And thanks to your voice and that of the Commissioner General UNRWA, who briefed you here last night. The idea is really not to make sure that people of Gaza have not been forgotten. So thank you so very much. I don't see further hands for you, or rather questions for you, excuse me. So I'd like to thank you again, Louise. You're always welcome to brief us here. And with that, maybe I'll turn back to you, Gabby. I know you have a question for Liz. So before we go to our briefer on Nepal, we'll take your question, Gabby. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Rolando. I'm so sorry that I'm asking a lot of questions, but today is a very special day for Mexico because we have a new president today, the first woman to hold that post, that her name is Claudia Sheinbaum. My questions, I have four questions, quick questions. One, who from the UN is going to Mexico to the inauguration of Mrs. Sheinbaum's post? Second question is, what consequences could have the initiative of Mr. Donald Trump, former president of USA, and Kamala Harris, vice president of USA, both saying that cartels of drug in Mexico should be named as narco terrorists? So what are the consequences of naming as a terrorist to the cartels of Mexico? Then, third question, so it's only three questions, I'm sorry. Mr. Putin was invited to the inauguration of new President Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico. But Mr. Putin has an arrest warrant against him, so for crimes against humanity, as you may remember. So do you think that if Mr. Putin go to Mexico could happen the same as Mr. Pinochet? I mean, because Mexico is a part of the criminal court. And also on freedom of expression in Mexico, several journalists, intellectuals have been critical to the government of Mr. López Obrador, have been fired from the media outlets that they used to work. Some of them are Héctor Aguilar Camín, former Minister of Exterior Jorge Castañeda, María Amparo Casar, Leonardo Curcio, and if you remember, I was fired too. So I just want to know, what do you think about this? Thank you so much. And I'm sorry for taking the time of your briefing, but I had a lot of questions. This is a very special day. Thank you so much.
No te preocupes. Don't worry, Gabby. I know it's an important day indeed. Just to mention that we don't, I don't know here at this podium who will be representing the UN. I will definitely check with colleagues, or you're free to do so yourself. In terms of your comments about Mr. Trump and Ms. Harris, of course, we don't, that is, the UN does not comment specifically on electoral processes, sovereign processes. We do obviously give general comments to ensure that that democratic processes are upheld and transparent, et cetera. But beyond that, we wouldn't be able to comment on specific comments from the candidates. And then I believe the other question was about Mr. Putin and then freedom of expression. So maybe there's something you can add on that, Liz.
Yes, thank you for that, Gabriela. Indeed, I personally am well aware that Mexico is about to have a new president. And as you've said, it is for the first time in Mexico's history that a woman has become president. And I think we can all agree that that sends a powerful message with regard to the crucial role of women in decision-making and their rights to participate in public affairs. With regard to your specific questions, I wouldn't want to speculate on what might or might not happen, should or should not the Russian president attend the inauguration. With regard to freedom of expression and obviously the work of journalists in Mexico, we have said on repeated occasions that their work is incredibly important, is vital, and they should be in a position to be able to report freely, to be able to voice opinions, as should everyone. What I think we would really say at this point, where indeed the new presidenta is about to take office, Claudia Sheinbaum, we really would encourage her to continue the efforts and consolidate the progress made towards poverty reduction and social equality in Mexico. We, as we often do, acknowledge that Mexico has complex challenges in addressing violence, which we often speak about here. We are concerned about the growing role that the military has taken in public security and other law enforcement functions. That should, of course, be the responsibility of public entities and of a civilian nature. One other thing I think we would really want to highlight at this point is that the authorities should really double their efforts to address the issue of disappearances in Mexico, which you, Gabriela, obviously know all too well, is such a huge issue. They should try and address this, double their efforts by bringing justice and effective remedies to the families of the victims. And if I may conclude on this, I think, as you know, the UN Human Rights Office, our office in Mexico, engages and has worked closely, not only with the Mexican authorities, but with many stakeholders. And I think as we now have a new administration in Mexico, we will, of course, continue to support the authorities and institutions at the federal, state, and municipal levels to promote and implement a solid human rights agenda in the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Liz, and thank you, Gabby, for your questions. Okay, and now I'd like to turn to the situation in Nepal. We have Azmat Ula, who is IFRC's head of country in Nepal. He's joining us from Kathmandu. He'll brief us on the situation of floods in Nepal. Thank you very much for your patience, Azmat.
Hi. Nepal has floods almost every year. I've been living here for 4 years, but This is totally different. I've never seen anything like this. I live within 20 minutes walk from one of the main areas where the major Kathmandu River Bagmati discharges, and it was like a mighty, mighty waterfall. I shudder to think what the toll of damages it would bring along its path and downstream. As you know, Nepal, Kathmandu is at about 1,500 meters in elevation. For more than 2 days, it rained, and it just didn't stop. I've seen a lot of major monsoons, but I've never seen one that doesn't have 1 minute of break. It's the speed of the flow and the quantum of flow which have led to the devastation and the disaster further downstream. So far, claiming about 200 lives and more than 40 people are still missing. The number can rise. The rapidity and of the flood waters sweeping away entire villages, homes, and very important livelihoods, as well as major infrastructure, such as roads, bridges, and even affecting hydroelectric station because of a lot of landslides, have caused a great toll. As I said, just to reiterate, where annual floods are common, I've never seen something like this. And it really stood out for severity. The human toll is profound, not only with lives lost, but entire communities. We have still quite a lot of communities south of the Kathmandu Valley being cut off from the rest of the country due to landslides and destroyed infrastructure. In Kathmandu alone, over 3,600 people have been rescued. And many have lost not just their homes, but entire livelihoods. Access to essential resources, such as fresh water, will be a challenge. And even when the flood water recedes, there could be a major outbreak of dengue. There are still many villages which are isolated due to impassable road and broken bridges. In response, the Nepal Red Cross and the IFRC have mobilized swiftly and effectively. Over 200 Nepal Red Cross volunteers have been working around the clock to help authorities with evacuation, search and rescue, as well as distributing essential supplies. The Red Cross has also been coordinating closely with local authorities to clear roads, restore access, especially in high elevation areas where landslides continue to pose significant challenges. So far, the Red Cross have distributed supplies to 5,000 people with the emergency relief items. Despite the destruction, these efforts are making a difference. Volunteers embedded in communities trained and prepared for a disaster like these have played a key role in initial response. Looking ahead, the Red Cross is preparing for long-term recovery, and the IFRC is currently finalizing an emergency appeal fund to further support Nepal's ongoing effort. So, ladies and gentlemen, just as the nation, to conclude, as the nation faces increasing threat of climate change, which has intensified disaster like this one, preparedness within communities, in our opinion, is the key. Having trained volunteers, having empowered volunteers within the communities, as well as having access to relief items. And finally, their coordination with local and national authorities is also of paramount importance in strengthening the humanitarian assistance for future challenges. The disaster highlights the need for scaling up these efforts to protect vulnerable communities in years to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ula. Do we have questions for our colleague? Yes, front row, Christoph, AFP.
Christophe Vogt, Agence France Presse. Thank you for taking my question and for the briefing. I was just wondering if you were talking about preparedness and at the end of scaling up the preparation. Do you have any idea of what the priorities would have to be to protect against this type of floods? Is it even possible? And how much do you think money would be needed?
Okay, thank you. So that's a very difficult question. As I said, I've seen many floods in Nepal and the South Asia region. I haven't seen something which came so fast. It was a little bit like a tsunami, very short and very fast. And as I said, that I think when a disaster hits, they are vulnerable people. And the response with the Red Cross network, positioning the volunteers within communities and having community volunteers, to me, is the key to deal with this. How do we, I mean, whether I can predict that such floods will come again, I don't know. But the climate change is changing a lot of things with glacial outbursts, not only in Nepal, but the whole region and beyond.
There was a question on the funding.
On your second question, we are hoping to, with our emergency fund, we are hoping to raise with our members, IFRC and its members, up to about 1 million Swiss francs at this stage.
Okay, thank you very much. Did you have a follow-up, Chris? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Ulla, for joining us and for your patience. And of course, preparedness is key, as we've heard here in many situations like this around the world. So thank you once again. With that, now I turn to our colleagues from WHO. Margaret Harris is here, and she'll have an announcement shortly, but maybe I'll just turn really quickly to two guests from WHO who are going to speak to a situation of arboviruses, Dr. Raman Velayudan and Dr. Diana Rojas Alvarez from the WHO. Over to you. Maybe, I don't know, Dr. Raman, perhaps we'll start with you.
Thank you very much. So today, the World Health Organization is launching the global strategy for preparedness, readiness, and response to tackle dengue and other Aedes-borne arboviruses, which will be published later today. The plan, as you have just heard from Nepal, dengue threat is global, and the plan aims to reduce the burden of the disease, suffering, and death from dengue and Aedes-borne arboviruses by fostering a global coordinated response. Dengue cases have surged across all WHO regions, with an estimated 4 billion people at risk globally. And the total number of cases recorded so far has reached 12.3 million and by the end of August, with over 7,900 deaths, and which virtually means the number of cases have doubled every year since 2021. Dengue, as you know, is a vector-borne disease transmitted by the bite of an infected mosquito. There are four distinct serotypes of the virus that cause dengue, and these are known as dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4. The majority of the infections are mild and may not be noticed. Severe dengue is potentially lethal and complicated, which can develop from a dengue infection, and usually it is the second infection which is more serious than the first. Factors such as unplanned urbanization, poor water supply, sanitation, and hygiene practices, climate change, and international travel have all facilitated this rapid geographic spread of the disease. The disease is now endemic in more than 130 countries, and similar trends have also been observed in other arboviral diseases, such as Zika, chikungunya, and more recently, the Oropouche virus, especially in the Americas. This global escalation underscores the urgent need for a robust strategy to mitigate the risk and safeguard the population, taking into account that urban centers are at greater risk. The vector mosquitoes have silently spread across several countries and continents. Parts of southern USA and several countries in Europe are also at risk of this viral disease. As some of you may recall, we had warning from the Swiss government on the spread of Asian tiger mosquito here. And even in Geneva, several localities were mentioned to have recorded these mosquitoes. Vast majority of these dengue cases reported in 2024 are from the American region, mostly from Brazil, and there are several other arboviruses reported from that region. To know more about these diseases, I will now request my colleague Diana to brief us on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Diana?
Thank you very much, Raman, for giving me the floor. So additionally to dengue, there are other arboviruses which are also climate-sensitive diseases, including in this global strategic and preparedness, readiness and response plan. So chikungunya is also a virus which is spread by the same mosquitoes and co-circulates usually with dengue. And to date, 118 countries have reported chikungunya transmission. The main burden of this disease is due to chronic disabilities and severe impact on quality of life. In 2024, over 465,000 chikungunya cases have been reported globally, with high circulation that continues in Brazil, where most of the cases have been reported. So as you hear, most of the cases, dengue cases, have been reported from Brazil. The same with chikungunya. We have high co-circulation of these viruses because they are transmitted by the same mosquito. And then we have other countries in South America. In India also has reported almost 70,000 cases as of June 2024. And there are some other countries that have reported transmission. You might remember Zika virus, which has a public health emergency of international concern in 2016. Zika is also spread by the same mosquitoes that transmit dengue and chikungunya, but it can also be transmitted sexually between people and from mother to child during pregnancy. Zika virus disease have declined globally since 2017, but they still occur in very low levels. We have 92 countries and territories that have current or previous spread of Zika virus by Aedes mosquito. And so far in 2024, more than 36,000 cases have been reported, mostly from the region of the Americas. But we have also increased number of cases in India, in the Maharashtra and Karnataka state. So since the Zika emergency was almost 9 years ago, it's enough time to accumulate susceptibles and to build to a new epidemic. So that's why this integrated plan is so important. And if it was not enough, we are also closely monitoring an emerging arbovirus in the Americas. The name is Oropouche virus, which causes Oropouche virus disease, which is also an arthropod-borne disease. But this one is not transmitted by the same mosquito as dengue, Zika, and chikungunya, but to the bite of an infected midge. So these midges sometimes are called nociums or jejenes in Spanish. So they are very small insects that usually bite during the day. They live in humid areas with organic matter and also in forested areas such as the Amazon basin. So this virus was isolated in the 1950s and has been circulating in the Amazon region since then. In 2024, we have detected an increased number of Oropouche virus transmission and expansion outside the Amazon basin, which is alarming or concerning. And as of September, over 11,600 cases have been confirmed, compared with last year, where 835 cases were reported in all the region during 2023. The symptoms are very similar to dengue fever, and it can easily be misdiagnosed in areas where we have co-circulation of these different arboviruses. There are currently no specific treatments or vaccines for Oropouche, as it's an emerging arbovirus, and you just treat the symptoms. Why Oropouche is a current concern? Because it's occurring outside the Amazon basin. So usually the Oropouche cases were reported in Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. But this year we have found Oropouche in Cuba, in the Dominican Republic, and areas that are not traditionally, who don't have traditionally Oropouche transmission. Also, several deaths have been reported in people with Oropouche for the first time. And we have confirmation of increasing Guillain-Barré syndrome cases, which is a condition in which the body immune system attacks the nerves. So it causes weakness, numbness, or paralysis. We also see Guillain-Barré with Zika, with COVID-19 and other infections. So this is concerning because the people who show Guillain-Barré syndrome, they need ICU. And then infection during pregnancy has been associated, potentially associated with fetal death and potential birth defects. So that's why we are doing further investigations on Orobuche. So we will keep monitoring all these virus arbovirus threats, and it highlights the importance of the global strategic preparedness, readiness, and response plan to tackle dengue and other arboviral diseases. And with this, we want to foster the global coordination and prepare the countries and the regions to be able to respond and prevent all these viruses. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you both very much. Very important updates indeed. We have a question from Gabriela Sotomayor of El Proceso.
Thank you very much, Orlando. Hi, Margaret. I have a question on Mexico. How is the situation of dengue and chikungunya and other countries in America, in Latin America, that are for your concern? And also the new one, I don't get it, how do you spell Olocucha or something like that? How is the situation also in Mexico? There are places like Acapulco, like Oaxaca, the for climate change, there are heavy, heavy rains, hurricanes, and the situation is really, really dire over there. So I don't know if you have noticed that, if it's in your radar, in your attention. Thank you so much, and sorry for asking
a lot of questions. No problem, Gabby. Thank you, Gabby. And I should note that Margaret has shared the notes with you with the correct spellings of everything that was mentioned, including Urupucha, if I pronounce that correctly. Diana, over to you.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Yes. So, Mexico is endemic for dengue and other arboviruses. They currently have the four serotypes that Raman mentioned co-circulating, and they have thousands of cases that have been reported. The same with chikungunya, it co-circulates. They even reported few Zika cases in the last year. So they have the three arboviruses currently co-circulating in most of the country. With Oropuche, it's an emerging virus, as I mentioned before, and it usually was just circulating in Brazil and in South America. But now our regional office, PAHO, has sent diagnostic kits to all the countries to start looking for this virus. As I say, it is transmitted by midges. It's not transmitted by the mosquitoes that are responsible for the transmission of the other two viruses. So additionally to testing all the negative cases for dengue, because the Oropuche virus disease looks very similar to dengue fever. Also, they are doing entomological, or they are looking for the vector who is involved, that in Mexico probably is called jejen, or that's how it's called in South America. So they are looking for this very, very tiny midge. And if if the midge is present, there is risk of transmission. However, in Cuba and the Dominican Republic, they are looking for other potential vectors that might be involved in the transmission, such as Culex kinsefasciatus and maybe other mosquitoes. But this is everything we are currently investigating, and we will keep you posted when we have more information. Thank you. Over.
Excellent. Thank you so very much to you, Diana and Raman. I don't see further questions, so we'll now move to our last item. Last but not least, Margaret is on the podium with me, and she has an announcement for us.
Yeah, just a couple of things. Later today, we'll be having a press conference at 2 o'clock by the Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, better known as SAGE. And they've got a lot of interesting recommendations on the use of a range of vaccines to prevent respiratory syncytial virus, cholera, polio, and the universal rubella vaccine. So definitely one worth attending. And we're sending the highlights of the meeting out to you very shortly. We aim to have them to you in your mailboxes, I think, in the next 15 minutes under embargo, so that you've got a chance to read it before we actually do the press conference. The other thing, tomorrow is World Oxygen Day, and you might wonder why we, WHO, have designated a day for oxygen, well, since we seem to have it all around us, but it's an absolutely critical, essential medicine. And it's something that has not been available in many, many countries. It's actually been a classic case of inequity, and a lot of our work has been to help countries develop the capacity to generate their own oxygen, generated at hospitals, so that you can actually provide this when people are suffering from pneumonia. It's the difference between life and death if you can't get oxygen. So that's why, and we've got some details and stuff on World Oxygen Day. I think that's it from me.
Great. Thank you very much, Margaret. Do we have questions for Margaret? No, I don't see that's the case. So thank you again for joining us, for your patience. And we're almost done. Just a couple of announcements from me, just to keep you on track, as always. Proceedings here in Geneva. We have the Committee on Enforced Disappearances, which will wrap up its 27th session this coming Friday, the 4th of October, after having concluded or issued its observations for the reports. Three countries reviewed during this session: Ukraine, Morocco, and Norway. The Human Rights Council is still underway. Today, the Council is reviewing various reports, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different reports, to finalize the process, the universal periodic review process for these seven countries, all available in the update shared with you. That's all day today at the Council. And then this coming Monday, the 7th of October, the World Meteorological Organization Secretary General, in fact, Celeste Saulo, she will be here with colleagues from the WMO to launch a State of Global Water Resources Report, State of Global Water Resources Report, being launched here in this room at 10 a.m. on Monday by the Secretary General of WMO. Two observances in addition to World Oxygen Day. Today is the International Day of Older Persons, and obviously we hear too often how the plight of older persons is direly affected through places that we hear: Ukraine, Gaza, Lebanon, Sudan, and so many other situations that we brief on here. So this is this year, the subject is Aging with Dignity, the Importance of Strengthening Care and Support Systems for Older Persons Worldwide. Lastly, just to mention that tomorrow is another observance message for the International Day for Nonviolence. And we shared with you a message from the Secretary General for this important observance, which actually is the commemoration of the birthday of Mahatma Gandhi. And of course, through his message, the SG notes the various crises and conflicts raging, including in Ukraine, Sudan, in the Middle East, and far beyond. And he uses this opportunity to note that, quote, "Gandhi believed nonviolence was the greatest force available to humanity, more powerful than any weapon. Together, let's build institutions to support that noble vision, which is needed now more than ever." So on that note, I end this briefing, but I do have a couple of questions popping up for me, I suppose. Christiane.
Thank you, Rolando. I was wondering whether Pascal is there and whether we can get an idea of what the Human Rights Council might be planning or might be happening there on the 7th of October.
Pascal's not here, but he's maybe tuned in, or at least colleagues from his office, and they're better placed to brief you, of course. We haven't heard of anything for our part, but I would maybe direct your question to Pascal to see if they have anything planned. Gabby.
Yes, thank you, Rolando. One question: at what age a person is considered old person? Do you know, Margaret?
I think it's more of a there is probably a definition. I mean, about minors, that's clear. It depends on certain interpretations. I feel old right now, I can tell you after this long briefing, but I don't know the answer to that. Do we know, Margaret? Margaret's coming back up.
Yeah, well,
hold on a second.
Just because I'm here, it varies from country to country. So each country gives their own definition. It's often over 65. It seems to be over 60. I've even seen over 50. For me, I'm well over all those ages, and I don't feel that I need a stick quite yet. So it varies from country to country, but generally probably over 60. I think once they give you a free bus pass, you can call yourself elderly.
Well, I'm not quite there yet, but thank you for that elaboration, Margaret. And with that, I wish you a good afternoon and see you here on Friday.